Now call upon our brother Greg then to lead us in the consideration of the subject, the Bible and emotion.
Okay, so we've had two classes so far, as everybody remembers. These classes are pretty far spaced apart, so I'm going to just recap briefly. Hopefully it won't put you to sleep, but I just want to set the context again, particularly if it's been a while since we got here. And then we'll look at the subject tonight, which is focused on greed. So the first class, we looked at how emotions are formed, what's the basis for them scientifically, and why they drive us to do the things that they do. And then we focused on the topic fear, which is something we all can relate to in one facet or another. And tonight I want to look at another sort of a negative emotion, what some people may call an emotion, which is greed. It certainly comes out of some of the things we say and do. So if you remember, we looked at where our sins came from, how they're formed, how our emotions are formed, how our senses process information, important, and how we even arrive at emotion. If you remember, one of the things that I think I've found out through my research on this subject is that I think basically when we're born, as newborns, we arrive with pretty much a clean slate. We really have very few emotions that are formed to any great extent, and we form them as our environment shapes us through our senses. So our senses, which is the data that we take in, to use more technical terms, come into our body, and those, our bodies and minds, and those help us to form the emotions that we have. And some, of course, we know are good, and some are bad. And Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 7. We don't certainly have to turn there. But the key verse, I think, he says, is, I find then a law, when I would do good, evil is present with me, but I see another law in my members. And so he talks about this contrast between the law of the Spirit and a law in his members. And it seems to be the law in his members that is causing him the problems, causing him to sin and transgress. It's a force in which only one man has ever overcome. And of course, that's the Lord Jesus Christ. He's the only one to ever overcome sin, not having sinned himself. His emotions, his senses never got the best of him. So it led us to think along the lines of emotions, because we don't really think too much about the things we feel and how we act upon them and how they cause us to do certain things. So we looked at how emotions are formed. We looked at that sort of example of the weather station. I won't look at that again tonight, but our senses, the five senses we have, basically provide us with raw data. We sight, we see, we touch, we do all of these sorts of things. We hear, we smell, etc. And they provide us with basically raw data. We're just looking around and seeing things. We're touching, we're tasting, all of those sorts of things. And we know our bodies respond to that data physically. And we'll look at the example just briefly of the girl with the ice cream in a minute. But if something is pleasurable, we can sense that. If something's unpleasurable, we process that as well. And so our senses process information in a very physical way. That's why I think Brother Thomas called the senses the sensorium, essentially, the way he termed it in Elpis Israel. So we have these five senses, and we looked at them, and the first time ever you perceive something, you get a physical response. I mean, if you've never tasted ice cream before, small child, they either love it or they hate it eventually, and they process information this way. This is good. There's a physical sensation that they like it. It creates that emotion-like, and you want more of it. So the next time somebody proposes going out for ice cream, hey, that's great. I really enjoyed it last time. And that gets reinforced over and over again. So the concept of like or love, that sort of thing, gets reinforced over and over. And so it repeats, and it gets stronger. And we all know that because it happens to us. And we use this somewhat silly example of the babies. But you can definitely see this happening if you've got young children who have never experienced things, and you start to induce things into their lives. So if you give babies mangoes or melons, they tend to enjoy them because they're sweet and they're tasty. If you're mean, you give the baby a lemon, and it immediately senses a physical reaction of dislike. And so, you know, the more lemons you give the baby, the probably the more it will dislike them until it'll be repelled by them. And so there's a sense provides the raw data. It's the emotion that comes out of it that causes us to react to that. And so you have those examples. So our emotions essentially are what shapes us and molds us. They imbue situations with meaning, and some of them are very good. Love, obviously, can be a very positive emotion. We found fear to be a very negative emotion. So fear tends to cause us all kinds of problems. Fear has been called the great mind killer because the worse the fear gets, the harder it is to think. After a point in time, if you have so much fear, you can become completely debilitated. You cannot think any longer. You can't react in a reasonable way. So emotions imbue situations with meaning, and they're important. We would always respond robotically if we didn't have them. So they can be important, but they can also cause us a great deal of problems. So I put forth a premise that said that if we had no emotions, if we weren't able to sense anything, like say we had no ability to taste, to touch, to see, to hear, I think my thesis might be is that we would never feel anything. We would never be able to feel any emotion, really. Emotions couldn't be developed. And as a consequence, we might even not even sin in the sense that we would sin today, because sin is a result, oftentimes, of our emotions. We tend to react badly sometimes to fear or to hate or to greed in this case and things like that. So emotions are really important, but they can be negative as well as positives. And as we said, they give life meaning. They give situations meaning. They're critical to learning and memory. They help us to relate to each other. And body language is very important in understanding how, I mean, you could tell right away if someone sticks their tongue out at you in displeasure, you get a sense right away without them saying anything what they're feeling. And you get a sense just on the expression of their face of what's happening with them. So it's very important. But negative emotions can lead to sin, as we know. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life. And we saw that in the garden, the very first sin in the garden by Eve, of course, and then Adam. So she saw the fruit. That's a sense. And out of that sense came the lust of the flesh. It was pleasant to the eyes. She saw it. Again, it's a sense. It was something to be desired, a lust almost, and it resulted in the lust of the eyes. It was a tree to be desired to make one wise. So you have those three basic categories of sin, essentially. It's a process that ends up leading to sin. And it's not a subtle one when you think about it. Our senses provide us with the data about what is around us. It's all benign. It's just data, raw data that comes into our minds. It's when our bodies react to it. You can see it in the process of the lemons and the mangoes with the babies, that it can be pleasurable or unpleasurable. And we start to form emotions around what we're sensing around us. And they really help to kindle our passions and to set the tone for how we start to behave, both with each other and the thought processes that go on in our mind. So our emotions kindle our passions because they're based on sense, our raw senses, essentially, our five senses. Our minds start to shape our behavior, which ultimately can lead to sin and transgression. So, same sort of thing that we've seen. So, it's this process that we looked at. You sense something. There's a physical response. There's an emotion. You like it or you dislike it. And you want more. Now, that might not be bad, necessarily, with ice cream. But it could be really bad if that gets reinforced. You see the next door neighbor driving up in their brand new Audi or something, or Lexus, or something you really covet that you don't necessarily need. We don't need any of those things. My Toyota or Hyundai works fine, but I might really start to build a desire for something better because theirs looks shinier and newer than mine. And it leads to envy, which becomes covetousness or greed and can eventually become hate. And that's the way it actually works. I mean, I can see that process in myself, and I'm sure everybody at some point in time has felt this themselves. You really have to think and stop and put the brakes on, if you can, on some of these things. It's a difficult cycle to break, because as we saw with the ice cream, I'm a diabetic. Ice cream is bad for me. I know it. Occasionally, I will go out and have one. It makes me feel sick, and I regret it. But the next time I look at it again, I think, boy, I'd really love that ice cream again. And I fall into the same trap again. It's because it's tasty. I really enjoy the taste of ice cream. Even though I know it's going to cause me some problems, I still give into that temptation occasionally. Because in many ways, our emotions, our passions rule our minds. On an intellectual basis, I can say to myself, the ice cream is bad, it's going to make me feel sick, and I'm going to regret it. But I still have it anyways, because I really want the pleasurable experience of the ice cream. It's the way it is. Those of us who have illnesses like that do capitulate occasionally to that gratification. That's the way we are. If you continue to do those things, they become habitual, and we know habits are very hard to break, really hard to break, actually. So just getting into what we're looking at tonight, we want to consider greed as an emotion for a few minutes. And technically, it might not be called an emotion as such, but there's a bit of a debate with psychologists as to whether greed is an emotion. But I'm going to tend to treat it as an emotion tonight, at the very least an attitude of mind, because it's important. Saying that whatever we think about, whether it's emotion or an attitude of mind, it's a direct result of our understanding of sin. The woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So it's a direct result of just what's going on in our minds. And we can see how that happens. I mean, we can certainly see it. We'll give examples of it in a few minutes. One of the online dictionaries defines greed as an excessive desire to acquire or possess more than what one needs or deserves, especially with respect to material wealth. Perhaps this is a really good example of greed. It's the direct result of the consequences of sins. It does deserve our attention, I think, because it's something we're all subject to, particularly in this day and age. There's so much you could say about greed. I got a little bogged down in just the sheer data that one could look at in regards to greed and the effect it's had on our planet, not only personally, but our entire planet today, our ecosystem, our economic situation, all of these sorts of things. It's had a massive impact on our planet and continues to have a massive impact, and on ourselves, because we live in a very greedy society in a very greedy day and age. And we know the effects it has upon ourselves. And I think most of us, to one degree or another, must wrestle with this problem. Because I know it pricks my conscience occasionally. I mean, there's a chance for a promotion, don't necessarily need it, but it's there, and it means more wealth, perhaps, or more possessions, that kind of thing. You really have to stop and think about what it is we need and what it is we don't need. It's debilitating. Greed is debilitating. It causes us to lose our focus on God. Our spiritual vision becomes clouded very quickly. In fact, if we said that fear is the great mind killer, and it's the great mind killer because we can't think anymore when fear becomes too great. If fear is the great mind killer, then greed is the great faith killer. It destroys our faith, absolutely. There's a couple of quotes I wanted to look at, but one interesting one. James Boswell, in his biography of Samuel Johnson, famous English writer, says he remembers the one day he went fishing with his father. This is Samuel Johnson's son. He called it the most significant day of his life with his dad. Later he got hold of his father's diary and read the entry, quote, for that day, went fishing with Sam, day wasted. And the reason he said that was because he could have been doing better things with his time, earning more money, doing the things that he really thought he needed to do. He wasn't at work making money, getting ahead in his career, that sort of thing. And when you think of that, how unfortunate for both of them. Went fishing with Sam, day wasted, because he felt he was losing a day of opportunity to do something else. There's a few things about greed that even non-religious people, secular people, say about concept of greed and its impact. And you can just look at how people in the world accumulate wealth and assets with no end in sight. At University of California, Berkeley, scientists have done studies on lots of things, but they analyzed a person's rank in society, measured things like wealth, occupational prestige, and education, and found that those who were richer than most were more likely to cheat, lie, break the law than those who were poor. I don't know quite how they quantified this or looked at it, but that was the result of the study. That the richer and more powerful you became, the more likely you were to abuse those sorts of things, to cheat, lie, and break the law. We found that it is much more prevalent for people in the higher ranks of society to see greed and self-interest as good pursuits, said the lead author of the study and a doctoral candidate at Berkeley. Greed is a robust determinant of unethical behavior, according to the study. What it comes down to really is that money creates more of a self-focus, which may account for larger feelings of entitlement. So people with more money tend to feel more entitled than the poorer of us. What they were really saying is greed is a measure of selfishness and self-worth. We know selfishness is defined as lacking consideration for others, concerned chiefly with one's own personal profit or pleasure. If it isn't technically ethical for those who are very powerful and very wealthy, it can certainly be justified at some point in time. We looked at another class not that long ago about climate change and why we have climate change and some of the basis for it. We looked at the global economic crisis and found basically that greed is at the foundation of all of these things. When you go right back to why we have a global economic crisis, why we have global warming, why we have the bulk of the wars and violence on this earth, why there's hunger and poverty, why there continues to be hunger and poverty, just to name a few, you could think that it possibly, I would suggest that it goes back to greed, basic human greed. It is a huge problem. I did a little bit of research, and you'll pardon my silly graphics, but just recently, there was a report put out by the Oxfam Association in England, and they did an analysis on the world's richest people. And we're not trying to pick on the world's richest people, obviously, but it's a good example of where our society has taken us. They basically said in their report that the world's 100 richest people earned enough money last year to end world extreme poverty four times over, according to Oxfam. 240 billion net income of the world's 100 richest billionaires would have ended poverty four times over, according to Oxfam. That's what they suggest. That is a staggering statement when you think about it. When you look at what the five richest people in the world own, as far as their net worth, it's staggering to think about these numbers. I won't go through them all in detail, but the Carlos Slim Helú, a Mexican corporate magnate, has $73 billion. Bill Gates, of course, everybody knows about, is $67 billion, and so on and so forth. The five most wealthy people in the world have billions of dollars between the five of them. In fact, if you go in and dig a little deeper, Forbes just published their top 100 richest people in the world. They have a combined wealth of over $240 billion. The top 1,426 richest people have a combined wealth of $5.4 trillion. That's up over $1.5 trillion, I think, in 1 year. That's their net worth is climbing at an astronomical rate. There's more billions being produced every year than there was the year before. In fact, if they were a country, they would be the fourth richest country in the world, even more affluent than all of Germany. That's a staggering statistic when you think about it. I guess the question I have when I look at this is not so much that this is something to be envied. What it says to you, and some of these people are incredible philanthropists, like Bill Gates has given away billions of dollars. His net worth, though, hasn't changed at all in the last 10, 15, 20 years. Basically, it stayed about the same. He has given away a lot of money, so kudos to him. But what could they do if they wanted to with this kind of wealth at their disposal? You have to think about that. If you think about what $1 billion even is, I have trouble visualizing that. I think if I've got 5,000 in the bank, I'm quite happy at this point in time. So, I mean, thinking about having $1 billion in the bank, if you were to stack it up on pallets, that's what it would look like. And there's been lots of statistics done. The annual income of you and almost 26,000 of your friends would equate to $1 billion. 26,000 average workers. If you stack them on high, it would be 3,583 feet tall. I mean, these are incredible statistics. It begs the question, I guess, is just how much is enough when you think about it? How much do you really need to get by in this world? What is enough? $1 billion is probably more than most people can even envision spending. I can't imagine. I tried to do a little exercise with myself, thinking, if I had unlimited resources, what would I buy? And I'm thinking, I could come up with a few hundred million, maybe, if I really stretched it to buy islands and fancy cars and stuff like that. But to have $1 billion, you could do whatever you wanted pretty well. It basically is extreme extravagance. Some of these things that you see on here, the jewelry, that the necklace there is worth $14 million. The car there is worth $2.5 million. The world's richest home is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. That's nothing to somebody with billions of dollars, though. How much is enough? It seems for some people that enough is never enough. It doesn't matter how much you put at it. We already know what God thinks about our lusts and desires. And we want to look at what God thinks about greed and covetousness. I'm not going to go through all of these, but these are common verses that we look at quite often to help remind us about what's really important. 1 John 2:16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Luke 12:15, he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. And yet there's lots of people, that's all that it is. It's the abundance of what he possesseth that's important. 1 Timothy 6:9, they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. So it's the danger of desiring wealth and having possessions. Of course, Matthew 6:24, you can see that. Psalm 10:3, for the wicked boasteth of his heart's desire and blesseth the covetous whom the Lord abhorreth. Proverbs 15:27, he that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house, but he that hateth gifts shall live. And finally, 1 Timothy 6:10, the love of money is the root of all evil, which some have coveted after. They have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. It's a problem. It's a real problem, and it's a problem for us because we're surrounded by it. This sort of wealth was only available to kings in the time periods before us. There's usually two classes, the poor and the rich, and very few rich. Now a lot of people have a lot of wealth. And the average person can go after wealth if that's what they want. That is a problem that we have to look at. It's the love of money, as Strong's Concordance defines this phrase as. So The love of money is the root of all evil. You can see in the King James, it's not quite the best translation, more correctly translated. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. That's what it's really about. It's not the root of all evil, because there's lots of other evils. But it is the root of all kinds of evils. It causes people to do things that they might not otherwise do. The wealthiest, it's kind of a conundrum in a way. The wealthiest may be rich, not in a bad sense. I mean, we certainly know about Abraham. He was rich, but not in a bad sense. He wasn't coveting after riches. God blessed him with riches, like Job. You have other men, on the other hand, like Gehazi and Achan, and men like that who really coveted after wealth and possessions. The love of money is not the sole root of all evil, but it's the leading root of bitterness, resentment, satisfaction, fretfulness, hopelessness, and in the end, it destroys faith, the root of all that is good. Its offshoots are envy, temptation, a snare, lust, destruction, and perdition. So we want to have a look at one example. I know there's not a lot of time for this, but just very quickly, one example. The greed of Gehazi. It's a very notable example. You can't read the Bible without finding lots of incidences. Certainly, Eve coveted the forbidden fruit. At Ai, Achan coveted gold, silver, and garments. Ahab coveted Naboth's vineyard, even though he was the king and had pretty much everything that he could want. Ananias and Sapphira lied to the Holy Spirit because they were covetous, and so on and so forth. If we turn back to 2 Kings chapter 2, I just want to briefly look at a couple of lessons from the example of Gehazi, because it's helpful for us to look at it, particularly when you contrast it with Naaman. It's not just a story about the faith of one Gentile. We tend to look at the story of 2 Kings chapter 5 and dwell on Naaman, which is a fantastic story. It's someone who had wealth and power and everything that somebody could want, except for one important thing, which was health, and would have been happy to give it all up because he ended up with faith. And it's the story of a contrasting character, Gehazi, who had everything that we might value and yet was willing to give it all up for the love of money. So you have Naaman, a Syrian soldier who had many servants, and we read how wise and good they were in verse 13 of 2 Kings 5. And the servants came near and spake unto him and said, "My father, if the prophet had bid thee to do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean?" So he had good servants who gave him excellent advice. We won't go into the story because we all know it. We have, on the other hand, Elisha, a holy prophet, a man of God who has but one servant, and he proves to be a greedy, base, and a liar as an individual. Elisha, his master, refused Naaman's treasures, but Gehazi coveted them. He desired them. Verse 20, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "Behold, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him." So you look at the decision of Gehazi to follow this path. And it's a path that is so easy to follow if we're not careful. Gehazi followed after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" So if you ever looked at those words, actually, there's a lot that's being told in those few words. He secretly followed after Naaman because Elisha certainly wouldn't have approved of it. He knew what he was doing was wrong, but his greed superseded his faith. His desire was to obtain or take away from Naaman something that belonged to Naaman. It had been offered to Elisha. Elisha refused it. It was Naaman's. And as we all know, sin starts with that process as a thought, as a little spark almost, a tiny flame, and it starts to burn. At first he had a desire, a thought. Now he decides to put it into action. And so in verse 20, he's thinking about it. And it upsets him that all this wealth has left. There was an opportunity to get quite rich here, And Elisha foolishly missed it. And so he says in his heart that I'm going to follow after. I'm going to run after him and take something from him. We can't let this wealth go. It's free for the taking. And so he starts following after Naaman, and then he starts running after Naaman, if you caught that. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" So perhaps he started with an idea conceived in his mind, a plan to go and get this money. He started walking towards Naaman, and then when he realized, I better, hot foot it to Naaman because there is a lot of wealth here, and I have a chance to get it. And so it's much like Proverbs chapter 2. We can go there just briefly if you want to turn the page there just for a second. But Proverbs chapter 2, it has been titled The Seven Deteriorating Ways to Evil. It starts out so innocuously, and then it gets progressively worse as you leave the path. So you're on the path that leads to the kingdom, and we've all done this at one time or another. But just beginning at verse 10, when wisdom entereth into thine heart and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, Proverbs 2 verse 10, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee, to deliver thee from the way of the evil man, from the man that does these seven things. And we won't go into it because it's a study in itself, but he starts speaking froward things. Then he leaves the path of uprightness. He starts to walk in the ways of darkness. So you can see him leaving a path that's filled with light, and it's starting to get darker. Now he's rejoicing to do evil, and he's delighting in the frowardness of the wicked, whose ways are crooked, and they are froward in their paths. If you look at all the words, froward and that sort of thing, you'll see they're different words as you go along. They get stronger and stronger until the person is so far off the path, there's no light anymore. They have completely left any semblance of light. So it's the seven deteriorating ways to evil. And I think this is the path that Gehazi followed. For the world, when you think about it, for people in the world, this must be a terrible battle when you have no biblical conscience to fight against or to prick your conscience when you start to think along these lines. You can see that the world is filled with luxury and excess, and sometimes we tend to display the same tendency. Something that belongs to someone else, some talent or ability that's beyond our reach, can seem so much more appealing than what we already possess. You know, the house that we own, it's great. It shelters us. It provides us with what we need. And yet we see the guy down the road or the couple down the road that have something bigger than us or better. And you have a tendency to covet it. I wish our house was a little bigger and we had a pool in the backyard. And you know, you can sense the way that works in your mind. It's the deception. I guess you could call it the deception of Gehazi if you were going to call it something biblical. 2 Kings 5 and 21 and 22. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments." Naaman or Gehazi had really thought about this as he had gone along. Had to come up with a good excuse for why he needed the money and the garments. He wasn't going to ask for everything. He wanted it to be plausible, enough to be plausible. So he concocts this crazy story about two sons of the prophets who need money and clothing. And Naaman, obviously, I think Naaman was no fool. He understood exactly what was happening, I think. Naaman was a truly changed man. Someone who went away out of the waters, not only cleansed of leprosy, but an absolutely changed man. He was a man of faith now. And I don't think he misunderstood what Gehazi was all about. Gehazi told him a deliberate lie that his master had sent him to him again after Elisha had been emphatic about not taking this money or the clothing. Gehazi thought he could deceive Elisha and deceive Naaman. I don't think he deceived either of them, obviously. And that appears to be one of the lessons of Gehazi. Certainly, we deceive others. It's oftentimes easy to deceive others. But the fact of the matter is, we cannot deceive God. There's lots of things in this incident which cause us to realize that even though we may try and deceive others, maybe that's who we're trying to deceive, God is not deceived at all. And so after he concocts this story, Naaman says in verse 23, "Be content, take 2 talents. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of garments and laid them upon 2 of his servants, and they bare them before them." And so he gives them this. He says, "Be content, take 2 talents. And so he sends Gehazi back with 2 young men to help him carry the burden, which was obviously a lot of money. And I think that Naaman realized the intent of Gehazi. He gave him a goodly sum without it being an absurd sum, enough to make the story even perhaps plausible. 2 talents of silver and 2 changes of garments, 1 for each of the sons of the prophets that they were supposed to be going towards. He could have offered him much more, but he offered just enough to adhere to Gehazi's story, which seems foolish when you think about it. It's easy for us to look at this as Gehazi being so foolish. But Naaman was gracious, I think, for what the prophet of God had done for him. He didn't question it. He didn't question the need, even though he may have well suspected the true intent of Gehazi. If Gehazi thought he could fool Naaman, he thought he could fool Elisha as well. And so back in 2 Kings 5, verse 24, when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand and bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, "Where have you come from, Gehazi?" And he said, "Thy servant went no whither, or not hither and thither." So, lest his absence be noted, Gehazi ran back hastily without being called, took the talents of silver and the garments and hid them, and then he goes to appear before his master, thinking that everything's all good now. And Elisha says, "Well, where have you been?" And he says, in a modern translation, "Nowhere, sir, out of the house. And so one lie is compounded another lie, and it continues to get worse and worse. It's like a downhill trend, essentially. He has to continue to tell lies because he's concocted all of these things, and now he's been actually asked where he was, and he's got to concoct another lie. Gehazi hadn't been spiritually alert, and because he hadn't, it caused him to do evil. So greed has a tendency to not only cause us to covet, but to do much worse than that. And that's the reason we have the problems we have today. If it was just simple greed for selfishness sometimes, we might not have a global economic crisis. But the reason we have a global economic crisis is because people can't stop coveting. In fact, $1 million isn't enough, and $10 million isn't enough, and $1 billion isn't enough. They continue to want more and more and more. And it doesn't matter what the cost is, whether it's the climate, whether it's the environment, whether it's the suffering of other people. There is no relationship to me. As long as I am taken care of personally, it does not matter to them. It becomes all-consuming, and they lose any focus for other people or for what God wants. So in verse 26, he said, "No whither." And he said unto him, "Went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and men and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. So He didn't realize, obviously, that God saw all of this, and it obviously revealed that to Elisha. It was foolish for Gehazi to attempt what he did. Certainly, in hindsight, or from our vantage point, we think he must be very foolish. But you know what? This happens to us. It happens to us as well. It's so easy for this to happen to us. It can. I see it in myself sometimes. I hope it's not what you find occasionally, but I think it does. It is part of our nature to want to covet and to want what other people have. It is very hard to fight against that. It takes real faith, which is the only thing that can counter it, to be able to fight against covetousness and greed. Obviously, Gehazi failed in that. And so he paid a huge price for it. The sin of Gehazi is so similar to that of Achan's when you think it. Think of it in Ananias and Sapphira. The end seems so obvious before the story is even told. You know what's going to happen. It's like a novel that you read and you already have figured out the plot to the end and you know what's going to happen. What is it that caused Gehazi and sometimes us to covet? The fact is, sin blinds people to the real circumstances and consequences with what they have to deal. It clouds our judgment, is what it does. And what we know in our hearts to be true. Once we start following that path of covetousness and greed, afterwards it becomes all-consuming and you can't think anymore clearly. Your whole sense of what is right becomes clouded because that becomes so important. It destroys the power of sensing the presence of God is what it really does. God gets pushed out of the picture and it gets replaced with mammon, essentially. Gehazi assumed about Elijah that he would not find out, as all sinners assume about Almighty God, that he will not discover anything. But God does find out. And even if we are deceived, and even if we deceived others, certainly God is never going to be deceived. Just as says in Chronicles here. Thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thought. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee, but if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever. That is the problem. We sometimes fool ourselves into thinking that God isn't watching. Just like we think we can fool each other, and sometimes we do, we think we can fool God, and that is a deadly mistake. Gehazi's leprosy was an outward sign of an inward spiritual condition, the fact that Gehazi's moral nature had been damaged, and he would never be able to retain his integrity. So he would carry his leprosy with him to the grave. And so we assume Gehazi had to leave the prophet and go to live with the lepers, and he would have to think about this for a lifetime, about the folly and the wickedness, which led him to throw away the fellowship and confidence of somebody like Elisha. To be able to work with Elisha, who wouldn't covet that in a way? If you're going to covet something, covet being able to be with Paul or Christ or Elisha or somebody like that. Not the gold and the silver and the garments that Naaman brought, which Elisha understood to be mere things of no importance at all. With Gehazi, it started out as a spark of a thought, and it fanned into a burning flame, which eventually consumed him. It became a consuming fire. So just in closing, we just want to look at the contrast between these two men, if you think a little bit about it. The characteristics of Naaman. When he came to Elisha, he had only heard about the fact that he could be healed. He didn't know much about him. He had very little knowledge of God. He had a very ungodly heritage. He had an ungodly job. He was a soldier, essentially. He had money, fame, and power. And yet he lacked health and he lacked happiness. How could you be happy without health? And yet in the end he had more faith than many in Israel. And his actions demonstrated that he had faith. When you look at the characteristics of Gehazi, he had a great deal of knowledge of God. He sat at the feet of Elisha. Well, who could not want that? He was an Israelite, obviously. He had a godly job as Elisha's servant. He was in a full-time ministry, essentially. He lacked money, fame, and power, and yet had God and the hope of the kingdom. He had less faith than most of Israel, and his actions demonstrated his lack of faith. It's a very sad, it's a really sad story when you read about it at this point in time. The problem with greed is it's debilitating. Certainly money pays the bills. I mean, I'm certainly not suggesting that we don't need to work and provide for our families and that sort of thing. That's not what this is all about at all. But we forget sometimes that money is just a means to an end, to putting food on the table, to giving ourselves shelter and clothing, that sort of thing, the necessities of life. It can't buy happiness. It can't buy health most of the time. Can't buy love. Certainly can't buy faith, and it can't buy eternal life in the kingdom. Anything that's of lasting value, it can't do any of those things. Greed, in its worst case, certainly at the beginning of it, and certainly at the end of it, destroys relationships, family and friends, on a personal basis. It is a destroyer of faith. When you look at the world around us, corporate greed is destroying the economy, the environment, relationships, people's health. It fuels wars, and it does all of these sorts of things, whether it's the oil companies, drug companies, clothing industry, we read about it just the other day, automobile manufacturers, weapon makers, financiers, technology companies, to name a very few. There is, in these big corporations, there's no social responsibility to consider people's welfare of the planet. It's all about earnings per share and the accumulation of wealth. It's about profit, etc. Examples of this are just too numerous. We could go at this all night and continue all night because they just continue throughout our society. In fact, I think it's my personal belief, and you may or may not agree, that without the intervention of Christ, I firmly believe that we would destroy this planet, and we would certainly not last another couple of generations, either through wars or through climate change or whatever it might be. We're on a path of destruction, that the only hope for mankind now is the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom. Without that, we would have no hope for our children or our grandchildren, for sure. We live in perhaps the most prosperous age in the history of the world. I think there's no question about that. We live in one of the most prosperous countries. The world can afford all sorts of things, money, possessions, and the abundance of what people want to do to pursue them. That's the world around us. But the lesson of Gehazi teaches us, if it teaches us anything, it's that without God in our lives and without the hope of the kingdom, we are miserable indeed. So we need to remain vigilant and keep our lamps lighted as we await the bridegroom, and that which gives real meaning to our lives. So God bless us all as we await the return of thy Son and the kingdom. Great, thanks.